evening, and welcome to Swords in Space Radio. I'm your host, Nicholas Wansbutter, back after a bit of a hiatus due to my health issues, my moving, getting ready to move the radio show to a new network, but we're back and hoping to be providing you with shows every week going forward. Tonight, we're going to be speaking about J.R.R. Tolkien's classic novel, The Hobbit. And tonight I'm joined by my guest, Matthew Zepp. And the music you heard a little bit of just starting off is from the introductory music to the film The Hobbit, which we'll be discussing next week, again with Matthew. But tonight we're going to be focusing on the novel. And just to introduce listeners to Matthew, he's actually lives right in my neck of the woods in southern Ontario in Canada. He spent 5 years in the seminary in both France and the United States, 3 months in a monastery, and then after all that managed to get himself a Bachelor of Arts in Rhetoric and Literature with a digital media specialization. And he's currently a high school teacher teaching English, expression and literature, drama, and French. He's a voracious reader with a myriad of interests, and especially in our area of interest, being science fiction and fantasy. But his real passion is writing, and he's recently launched a website called Brav's Index, which we will discuss a little bit in the later in the show, which is his place to showcase that passion. But we'll get to that a bit later, and thank you very much for joining us, Matthew, and welcome to the show.
It's good to be here. It's good to have you back, eh, Nicholas?
Yeah, thanks. And rhetoric and literature with digital media specialization is a, I may say, a rather eclectic mix for
well, you made it sound pretty good, I have to admit, yeah.
So, The Hobbit, I'll give a very brief synopsis. It's one of those works that I might be tempted to assume everyone's read, but I myself only read it a few years ago for the first time. So, it's the tale of Bilbo Baggins, who's a hobbit, which are short creatures with big feet and good appetites, who likes a good life, who gets jarred out of his comfortable life and dragged on a quest with 13 dwarves and a wizard named Gandalf to go and retake the dwarves' mountain home, the Lonely Mountain, from the dragon Smaug, who had taken control of that about 100 years previous, if I remember the novel correctly. And it's a classic adventure type of tale following their progression as they travel across Middle Earth, which is the world they live in, to get to the mountain and ultimately attempt to reclaim the dwarves' home. So I've called it a classic right off the start, and I know in the pre-show, Matthew, I want to get you to talk about how some of this ties in with Saxon mythology and how Tolkien worked that in there. But before we dive into that, I'd be interested in your thoughts on, just in general, why is The Hobbit a great work, or why is it something that that everyone should read?
Well, like yourself, I actually discovered The Hobbit years after I'd read The Lord of the Rings. Not that I dismissed it, it's just I don't even think I really knew too much about it. It didn't seem that interesting after you've read The Lord of the Rings, you know, that epic scope. But yeah, once I read it, I actually liked it better than Lord of the Rings initially. Now I guess they're at par. But yeah, it's got all those classical themes of adventure. I mean, you've got, you know, the whole idea of the quest, the epic quest. A good epic quest really can't go wrong, but when you have somebody like Tolkien with his incredible linguistic background and his he just knows all these mythologies. I mean, the man was a walking encyclopedia. And he's able to infuse all of that in there, and I would argue his Catholicism. I mean, you've got a huge wellspring there. And, yeah, it's just so fun to follow these dwarves and, you know, the classic Mr. Nobody who shouldn't be going on a quest goes on a quest, and you just watch the character evolve and triumph, and where everyone else was supposed to be better, he just comes and, you know, gets better and better as the journey goes. And so, I mean, it really takes you for the ride. And so I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, it's an absolute must to read. It's a great trip. If you just come at the book for fun, it's a great trip.
Yeah, and perhaps its shorter length makes it a little bit easier to be a fun read than Lord of the Rings. I mean,
certainly,
despite the fact that Peter Jackson somehow seems to have been able to torture it into a 12 or 14 hour monstrosity.
Let's warn the listeners right now.
That'll be a debate for another time, perhaps. But it's fairly concise. He wrote it intending it for his story for his children.
Just so, yes.
But by no means a work that I would say only children should read. I mean, it's great for adults.
Well, that's why the listeners. I'm sorry to bump in here, but the listeners, if you didn't like Lord.
Hello? I don't know if we're still on the air or if we've just lost Matthew, because I'm not hearing anything anymore. Yeah, hi. Okay, we're still on.
Oh, there we go. Yep, I'm still here. Sorry about that. Okay. I don't know if that was me or you.
I don't know either, but...
Okay.
Anyway, sorry, carry on.
Yeah, I was just saying, if they didn't like The Lord of the Rings, they really should give The Hobbit a chance. Because like you said, it was a different audience, a different intended audience, much simpler story. And it's not to be dismissed if you didn't like the books, and much less if you just saw the movies. If that's your impression of Tolkien, you got to give The Hobbit a read.
Right. And I think excellent point that you brought up as well about as the morality of the work, which I think is important. I mean, it's something that sets The Hobbit apart from a lot of the type of things that we see nowadays, and part of what makes it great. I mean, one of the very, very early shows of Swords and Space Radio, before it really was Swords and Space Radio, we discussed The Hunger Games, which has a lot of the adventurous elements, almost a bit of that quest element as well, but I think where it totally fell on its face is it had no morality to it, or no, nothing uplifting to it, nothing, and it was really lacking any sort of morality.
Yeah, and you know what, it's also the, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, it's also the element of hope. That's another thing that I just don't see anymore in movies. Like when Bilbo sees the eagles coming, you know, you have this huge battle, the Battle of Five Armies at the end of The Hobbit there, and he sees the eagles, and he says, the eagles are coming, the eagles are coming. He does the same thing again, Tolkien, in The Lord of the Rings, when, you know, everything looks like it's lost in Mount Doom, you know, and then the ring gets destroyed, and, you know, Sauron just falls like that. That kind of, you know, great... rising of the soul, you know, that, you know, it's something that you really don't see anymore in books. Books kind of, I don't know, the hero just gets to plow through everything, and, you know, you never really believe that things are going to not work out, but they work out in such a worldly way that it's not uplifting.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you mentioned at the start of your comments on what makes a great work, is Tolkien is this walking encyclopedia, as it were, with just a vast wealth of knowledge. And I think it's been said that Lord of the Rings was meant to be sort of a mythology that he felt the English people were lacking. But certainly The Hobbit has all kinds of Saxon mythology kind of woven into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, did you? I know you've studied a lot on that. Were there a couple points that you'd bring out of elements of Saxon mythology in the work?
Well, I wouldn't say so much that the Saxons had, well, you know, it's not entirely true. The English did develop their own mythology, but they've got a lot of the kind of Germanic Norse coming in there too. The ravens and the whole kind of dwarves and the peoples of Middle Earth and the magical infused items, especially rings. You'll find that especially in the Germanic legends. Like even the idea of a ring that corrupts people, that's not Tolkien. That's something that's been around for centuries. These elements that he wove together, they're definitely his own. Like he definitely created his own world and made his own thing. I think I'm correct in saying this, but I don't know if anyone knows, but like things like Dungeons and Dragons basically took his world and ran with it. You know, this idea of fantasy that he created, the orcs and everything like that.
The things he created, that's like the it's like the default position of fantasy since the 1940s when he wrote these.
Yeah.
I mean, not just Dungeons and Dragons, anything. It's just so standard to have dwarves and elves and dragons and trolls and orcs. Orcs always is the bad guy. And elves and dwarves, they're all portrayed in the way that Tolkien portrays them, too.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
yeah, he really rebooted the genre.
Yeah, The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings are almost like the, if I could use this analogy, almost like the IBM of fantasy fiction, and then everyone since then has just been, doing clones or knockoffs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he took all those myths and legends and he just, he put them in a new form. And, I mean, the fantasy genre has been huge ever since. I mean, like you said, you can go to any bookstore and it's just saturated with fantasy novels, and you can just see, these were all made possible by Tolkien. Whether or not they followed in his moral footsteps is a totally different question, but this world that he created just inspired so many. Yeah, and to get back at the actual history, one of the great things about Tolkien is he really knew his Anglo-Saxon poems and things like that, Beowulf being huge on that level. I'd be able to reference quite a few things, but the most striking of all is the whole thievery of the chalice or cup from Smaug's treasure trove. I mean, it's quite a salient scene, he has, for those who haven't read it, Bilbo the Hobbit has this little, he kind of talks in riddles with the dragon, doesn't really want to give too much away. Dragon knows he's there, they have a little exchange. And then the dragon says, well, I know you stole my cup, and if you read the passage, it reads exactly like the Beowulf passage, exactly. So these elements that he reintroduced were just splendid to read, from my opinion. You could just see how well he wove them in. And, I mean, there's dozens of them all throughout the text.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I think really sets the Hobbit apart from a lot of contemporary fantasies. Throughout the work you have these little poems or songs pop up that the characters will recite.
Yeah. Well, that's another interesting thing, because not all of them, mind you, but most of them, what Tolkien was doing there, and mind you, I don't know about you, actually, okay, let's be honest here. Do you enjoy Tolkien's poetry, like when you see it and you read it inside the narrative?
To be honest, other than the dwarves song, I think I've tended to skip over a lot of it. Start stretching to more than a page.
Yeah. I won't pretend that I am in that camp too. I don't know if it's great poetry. I'm not going to be a critic there. I'm not a poet critic, but yeah, I had the exact same reaction. It was only an Anglo-Saxon class I took in university that I kind of revisited these poems, and it was by accident. I was reading The Hobbit again, just a few passages, and I now know what he was doing, because he's doing Anglo-Saxon poetry. As you know, most oral cultures, they have a meter, a way of rhyming, and the meter of their epics, their songs, whatever, And what Tolkien was doing was he was doing the double stresses and the alliteration. I mean, he has end rhyme. And for those that don't know, end rhyme was kind of a Norman introduction when the Normans came and invaded the Saxons, that French influence. But before that point, it was alliteration that really made English poetry, Anglo-Saxon poetry. And that's what he's doing. So from a technical aspect, it is fascinating that he is doing that. I don't think anyone out there tries to make Anglo-Saxon poetry in contemporary times, but that's what he's doing. So, yeah, when you read it, it's kind of like, well, you know, it's bragging a bit. But technically, it's fabulous stuff. So, mm-hmm. There you go.
Well, I'm a bit of a philistine when it comes to poetry, I have to confess.
Okay.
So maybe that's why I skipped over it.
Fair enough. But I love poetry and I still skipped over it. So, you know, I'm not saying he's a bad poet. He's published, I'm not, so.
Right.
But there we go. Yeah.
You mentioned the riddling talk with the dragon, but then, of course, there's also the famous scene of the riddles in the dark where he's having the riddle competition with the creature
yes.
Gollum down the heart of the
yes.
mountain. So does that have a tie-in with something in Saxon mythology as well, or is that something he kind of...
No, absolutely. Anglo-Saxons love their riddles. Actually, we cover a few themes here, actually. If anyone listening has a copy of The Hobbit on their shelf or beside them, you can take a look at the cover. Most of the covers, I know for sure, in the 91 version, edition, and I think it is the 2006, they have those runes along the border. You know what I'm talking about there? Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I
yeah. do. Yeah, these runes, these are not even, you know, proper to Tolkien. I mean, he made his own set, but they're basically the Futhorc runes that existed before the written language. I mean, these runes were very angular. They were to be carved into objects before the monks came and introduced, you know, the Roman alphabet, Phoenician alphabet, as you will. And, I mean, even back then, what the Anglo-Saxons used to do was when they were doing poems, well, not all of them, but we have some evidence, not much exists anymore, of course, some of them would spell out their name using the first letter of each line. They'd put their name in runes. So it's almost like a riddle. They're signing their names in riddles. And, of course, as we go on in the Anglo-Saxon history, you can see this in the Exeter book, for instance. They've got these riddles throughout, which is quite amazing because these manuscripts have all this, you know, history and, you know, they're great epics. And then you have, like, riddles thrown in. Like, it's like, what's this fluff thrown in? And some of them, I mean, if anyone's going to look these up, you have to watch out. Some of them are a bit ribald, but... They have this great love of riddles. It's all throughout the history, and that's exactly what I think Tolkien was tapping into there, that love of riddles that the English people have. And it's also his way of having a contest, you know, because Bilbo is not a physical character. He's not going to, well, you know, sometimes he pulls out Sting, which is his sword, for those who don't know. But he's not that kind of physical character that he's going to just go toe-to-toe with somebody. But he battles in riddles with Gollum, and this is kind of his great battle scene, if you will. So, yeah, very, very traditional. Really, really traditional.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the creatures that doesn't seem to occur as often as the orcs and dragons, that is spiders. Is there, you know, different cultures, I know if they have certain things that they seem that they're terrified of or that are... always associated with evil. Is there something special to spiders in Anglo-Saxon culture?
Oh, you're going to have me reaching here. To my knowledge, no. I mean, they had a lot of totem animals, as you can imagine. The boar, mm-hmm. the snake, things like that. I don't really recall anything about the spider. If you really want to get, I don't know, you could maybe argue the fact that the Celtic interlace, you've probably seen those Celtic designs or images that have that great interlace of different lines going into one another. That's about as close as I get, and that's quite a reach, and I don't know where you'd go with that.
All right. Well, you know, yeah. That may well just be him making good use of something that many people just tend to be frightened of or disgusted by.
Yeah, it might even be personal. Who knows? For instance, one of the great parallels is the Riders of Rohan. You know, Rohan. The Anglo-Saxons are supposed to be these riders, like right down to the mead halls, these giant mead halls. Everyone thinks it's Norse, but it's actually him making them Anglo-Saxons, except the Anglo-Saxons didn't have horses. So you're wondering, well, why this sudden infusion of horses when it's so, it breaks the allegory or the metaphor or the parallel, whatever you're saying here. And it's because he actually loved horses. For those that don't know, Tolkien was I think he was a cavalry officer. Yeah, he broke the horses in, and of course World War One came along and such. But he was in charge of breaking the horses, so he gives them horses. And yeah, it has nothing to do with Anglo-Saxons whatsoever. So it might be the case here. Maybe he just didn't like spiders.
Well, and I guess great fiction comes from that, because I think that the Rohan being the horse masters is one of the things that made them great.
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
Now,
I mean, they would have really fallen on their faces. Sorry?
Yeah. No, just finish your thought.
No, I was going to just say they would have really fallen on their faces if they had just had a battle with them just being foot soldiers. I mean, it would have been pretty brutal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. For those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to Swords in Space Radio, and today our topic is the novel version of J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. And today I'm joined by Matthew Zepp as my guest. And if you're listening live, you can call us at 949-272-9417, or you can leave a question on the Swords in Space Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/swordsandspace, all one word. SWORDSANDSPACE. Now, moving on, Matt, I want to talk with you a bit about, you know, some of the themes that come up in the work, and we've alluded to these a little bit in talking about why we think it's a great novel, what makes it great. And one of the themes that we were talking about in the pre-show was, as part of the quest, kind of the Christian journey that Bilbo goes through. I don't know if you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah. Yeah, this, again, is also a great Anglo-Saxon theme. The whole idea of Christian as pilgrim, which I think is familiar to Catholics nowadays even. We still think about that. Or ourselves in that way, pilgrimage to heaven. And Bilbo is definitely joining that great tradition. Throughout the Anglo-Saxon works, we have the great Physiologus, well, fragments of it. One of my favorites out of that and of our people here at Brass Index is The Whale. And it's about how you have to, you know, you can't stop for the distractions, the whale being like an island. And if you anchor on it, then you fall into Satan's trap, a distraction, and the whale pulls you down to the depths of the ocean, which is supposed to be hell. And we see that with Bilbo as a pilgrim. He's, like you said right at the beginning, he's really comfortable. He's got the good life. Dwarves knock on his door, and he's brought into this, you know, hunger and deprivation and danger and fear. And he's moving towards something, though. Obviously, heaven would be the allegory, but it's the reconstitution of a civilization in the book. I would call it that. Would you call it that? That's his goal?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
because the dwarves have been kind of wandering in exile for 100 years.
Yeah, aimlessly so.
And,
though. Yeah.
Right, and now they're going to come back into their kingdom.
Yeah. It's subtle, but you can see the connections between the Anglo-Saxon there and the Hobbit, I would say.
Right. And that theme seems to come up again and again through the work. It seems like every time they're just getting ahead or they stop for a bit of a break, then bang, something else, some other calamity befalls them or something else hits
yeah.
them.
Exactly. Every time they try to take a rest, you'll see they come across the trolls at night. They come into a cavern to take shelter when the mountain giants are throwing stones at each other. They try to take refuge in a cave, and that's when the goblins get them. There's tarving in the Mirkwood, and the elves won't give them any shelter, and the spiders get them. So, yeah, every
right.
time they try to get away from the pain or the deprivation, that's when, yeah, they get into even worse trouble. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, and with the spiders especially, they leave the path that they've been told they cannot leave.
Excellent, yeah, it's just so, yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, is the growth of the character as well. Like, you know, there's that theme you're saying, not being unable to kind of stop and rest, continuing towards the goal. But the growth of Bilbo as a character over the course of the book is a great thing to watch happening as you read it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he's a bit soft. In fact, I have to admit, at the very beginning of the book, he was kind of a curious character, but it's kind of like, not really a fan of this guy. But yeah, and I remember you touching upon this. The dwarves don't exactly, well, they're not exactly endearing either, let's put it that way. And then you can see Bilbo kind of grow in their estimation, but also, yeah, he grows morally. He becomes more astute and... he's able to bear these sufferings much better, let's say, than almost anybody else, I'd say, by the end of the book. He's really the one to look at.
Now, the dwarves, maybe we'll discuss them a little bit, and I think it might give us some grist for the mill for next week when we discuss the film, because to me this is one of the... areas where the film departed, I don't know if departed is the right word, but I thought the portrayal of the dwarves was a bit different. Cause the dwarves are, and they've got a certain likability about them, but they're kind of jerks throughout the novel, I thought.
Yeah.
I mean, they come through when push comes to shove, but... you know, they're always kind of thrusting Bilbo in harm's way and, you know, always grumbling, well, you know, we hired you to, you know, do this or that, so time for you to deliver.
Yeah. I have to admit, one of the reasons I hate watching movie adaptations of books is because it starts to blur them in my mind. Like, I can't always differentiate between what I saw in the movie and what I saw in the book just because the images are so salient. But, yeah, the dwarves in the book, I mean, I forget in the movie, who's the one that has, like, the giant forearms with the double axes? What was this guy's name? Do you remember? Was it Balin?
Oh, I can't, no, it wasn't Balin, because Balin is the oldest of the dwarves, and...
okay, yeah,
so
you're right.
One of the
right.
big ears and the white beard in that. But
yeah.
In the novel, he's always described as having a red hood, and he's the lookout man, and he's kind of the old, experienced dwarf.
That's right, yeah, you're right, yeah. I can't put the name to it, but yeah, the dwarves in the movie are just, you know, they're epic, and I mean, even some of them look quite handsome compared to what we experienced with Gimli, and in the book, the whole concept of the dwarves, they come across as almost, I don't know, did you get the idea they're kind of runty? Like, I know the dwarves, but they come across as kind of, they just don't have that noble quality at all, almost, I would say.
Yeah.
In the movie, completely, I mean, they're larger than life. I mean, they're dwarves, but they're larger in life than life in the movie. They're really,
Yeah, although, as I say, in the novel, they do come through at the end.
Yeah.
Once you get into the Battle of the Five Armies and kind of the first time almost all seems as lost, they kind of come to their senses and come to the aid of the elves and the men and their brother dwarves who are fighting against all the orcs.
Well, that brings me to my favorite character, Beorn, the bear man. What do you think of him? I really liked him. He was my favorite in the book.
Well, he's an interesting character, but what do you, what about him makes him your favorite?
Oh, what am I basing that on? Well, again, I'd have to kind of point at Beowulf. Beorn means bear, and Beowulf means bee wolf, a wolf that, you know, goes after bees. Bees make honey. Therefore, it's what's called a kenning. Again, we're going kind of at the riddle angle here. The Anglo-Saxons, when they didn't have a word for something, they took two words and smashed them together. Suddenly, you've got a new word, right? So, Beowulf meant bear. So, Beorn is the bear man, and he eats the honey. He lives in an Anglo-Saxon style hall. I mean, it's all there. It's quite obvious that he's Tolkien's version of Beowulf. He fights with his bare hands. He's as ferocious, and it's exactly like the kind of crazy, go into battle alone, barehanded, super strong Beowulf version. And I just love how he's practically invisible. The whole army, the whole war gets turned just because this guy entered it. I mean, it's just unbelievable. He goes in, he rescues, I forgot the king's name. What's the King Dorse name? Oh, dear.
Thorin Oakenshield.
Thorin Oakenshield, thank you. Wow. Yeah, he goes in, he rescues Thorin, and then he just, he puts Thorin out of battle, then he goes in again, and he goes right for the Great Goblin, takes out the bodyguard, Bolg, I think his name is, B-O-L-G,
yep.
And he takes him out single-handedly. I mean, this guy is just,
he's
walking
right
epic.
He cuts right through Bolg's bodyguard, who'd been impenetrable up to that point in battle. And then, grabs Bolg and crushes him. I guess it's a bear hug.
And when the dwarves first meet him, this is not his first appearance in the book, for those who haven't read it. The dwarves initially meet him, I think, just before Mirkwood, and they're invited to stay, and he's hospitable. But, there's a danger about him. You don't cross this guy. You take his hospitality, play by his rules, but, if he figures out you're an enemy, you're done. It's just over. And when they tell him about, we escaped from some orcs, did you now? And then he goes out the very next day to kill these orcs. I mean, the guy is just pure mission mode. It's hilarious. I love it.
Yeah. Well, and that's when he decides he really likes them, because he was, he's pretty gruff with them and kind of skeptical at first. And then when he finds out they killed some orcs, and he goes and finds an orc and gets the story out of him, and then chops his head off and puts it on a pole. And then
he's
best buddies with him after that.
it's great. The enemy of my enemy is my friend here. Immediately, you don't like the orcs either? Okay, you can stick around. Yeah, it's great stuff. I think actually he puts that head right at his home. Doesn't he stake them around his house?
Yeah, outside his house, yeah.
I mean, it's a great lawn ornament. It's pretty funny. Coming from the Anglo-Saxon angle.
Yeah. But, that's one of the another interesting thing about The Hobbit is, it's meant for children. It's kind of it's not as epic, and it has, I'm not sure what the word I'm looking for, but, it is not that much of an adult type of thing, but there is still some toughness to it, like Bjorn that we're discussing there, and, there's real battles in that as well as the fun stuff, and I think one of the things I like about that is sometimes in modern times, people, when they think of Christianity or Catholicism, they think of kind of this overly pacifism, and everyone's nice, and we don't say anything to hurt anyone. We apologize for the Crusades, and we apologize for this, and whereas this is, I think, a bit more of bit more of the tougher side of being Christian that is there as well.
Well, I think people have completely forgotten what Catholic literature consisted of, because even by our own standards, The Hobbit is pretty tame. I mean, if you read Dante's Inferno, he's got popes in hell. He's got, one guy eating the back of the other guy's head. Like, when, Dante wants to talk to him, he literally wipes his bloody mouth. The guy's gnawing on the guy's brain. He wipes his mouth on the guy's hair and then starts talking like he's just been eating, like a bagel. And you can have Chaucer, if you read Chaucer, who has, he has some pretty randy tales in there. I'm not going to defend those, but, there's this huge, history we have of quite diverse literature and where we went with it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm not saying they did these things just to shock or awe. I mean, they had a point behind why they did these and wrote these things. And I would say The Hobbit is pretty tame by comparison, really.
Yeah. Right. Thinking of oral traditions, also the Chanson de Geste, I've read a fair few of those, and I mean, it's just full of, you know, this knight hewed his head, through, crushing his helm down to the jawbone,
yeah.
And, the brain splattered on his feet. And
Yeah, nowadays we've kind of disinfected our literature. I mean, piety by all means is great, but I mean, you've got to have also a kind of a realism and like the grittiness, because, people will meet piety with cynicism if they feel that you're kind of, I don't know what you would say, cheating, you're making it unrealistic, this is not what the world is like, how do you deal with real problems, sort of, you know what I mean?
Right.
And yeah, these gritty, if you read the Catholic stuff, I mean, Pope's going to hell and, the real, injuries and tortures, this is how war is, this is, the reality of disease, this is the reality of sin,
Yeah.
Sin is an ugly thing,
yeah,
and the consequences.
Yeah, it's the reality of life in this world.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there may be a, there's a certain danger, there's a certain mindset. Sometimes you seem of almost this idea of like, we're just, angelic forms that are, that were kind of separated from this, so we shouldn't ever read about that or see that, or, we should just be.
Yeah.
And I think your point is well taken, that can bring about a certain scorn, because, that's not real life. I mean, real life is often rather messy.
Yeah, and things aren't wimps. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think The Hobbit portrays it well, because I think it's still certainly suitable for children to read without being, traumatized by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, it's kind of tastefully done in a way, if I could say it that way.
Yeah, I mean, let's remember that Tolkien was a father. He wrote these for his own children. So, I mean, he's stuck a few head on pikes, but it's nothing explicit. We're not talking like gory stuff details here.
Yeah. Although that's one of the beefs with the film that I'll perhaps raise next week, and maybe we'll be a bit more controversial next week.
No, I'd actually agree with you there. I'm not going to say it either. Won't spoil it. But there are two scenes where I was like, "What the?" I found it really in bad taste. But we'll save that. Okay.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, we'll save that for next week. So we're moving along pretty well, but we're getting close to our end of the time to discuss The Hobbit, because I want to make sure we have some time to talk about Brav's Index, which is something I know you're really excited about, and something that I think is a great addition to the world of science fiction and fantasy. But before we move to that, any final thoughts on The Hobbit?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. Yeah, I want to just touch upon one of the Catholic themes again here. We've kind of danced around it a bit, not because we're trying to miss it, but we've been talking about so many things. But the whole idea of, possession, and Bilbo, he's uncomfortable in his home, he possesses his home, he possesses his stuff, he's very comfortable. The dwarves come, they are depossessed, they don't have their home, and so, we have this whole kind of, I'll give up, my comfort in order to give you comfort, in order to restore your home. But what we find is when the dwarves finally do get their treasure, and they Smaug is dead, they get in there, the whole place is theirs again, the greed that goes into it, that possesses, that poisons the dwarves, and then you see how the lakemen, the Smaug, when he arises, he thinks the lakemen are responsible for the thievery, and he goes and he raises their town there. And then the lakemen are without a home, And the dwarves, who have just regained this home, who know the incredible, you know, pain and angst of not having a home, they refuse to give of this great bounteous treasure to help rebuild. And I think that was a very interesting point. We'll see it again in The Lord of the Rings with the ring. I think this was a huge theme for Tolkien in his works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's another thing that makes it great, because it's a very poignant commentary on human nature and the dangers of being attached to things.
Yeah, and we see the way the whole thing is, well, the way Bilbo tries to defuse it, is he takes the Arkenstone and he offers it to the elves who are at the gate and the men as a bargaining chip, because that's what Thorin loves the most. And he
right.
just, you know, Bilbo just gives it over. It's supposed to be the most valuable thing in the whole horde, and he just hands it over to them and says, well, you know, he might be more reasonable if you say you're going to bargain with that. And he just walks away from it. I mean, his
right.
detachment from comfort at this point in the book is, it's just, you know, he's completely a new man.
Right. Well, we're just about ready to go to the Event Horizon segment of the show, but I see we've got a caller, so we have time to take the one call, and you're on Swords and Space Radio.
Hi, good evening. My name is Francis from Boston. Good job, Nicholas and Matthew.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, so I've been listening to your show. Very, very interesting points you bring up there, trying to tie it up. To tie the Hobbit into the Christian journey and all that. One thing in particular that you mentioned, Nicholas, that the Hobbit is for children, and that it also didn't have a lot of action or things for adults, if I'm not mistaken. But then again, I was thinking that if it's for children, then it's for all of us, because if you look at Bilbo, Bilbo is a child. Because, or in fact, let's say his whole race are children, and we are all children. We like this comfortable, no-hassle life, and some of us may have very powerful professions, but in the long run, we don't want to take the real responsibilities that I think God has set for us. And Bilbo is very, very comfortable, and he takes this man, Gandalf, to wake him up. So in that sense, I would say that the book is really for everybody, for adults, if you want, in particular, because we always shy away from our responsibilities and crosses and whatnot. You just don't want to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's,
I
actually
agree, absolutely. Yeah,
it's a great point. It actually reminds me, Gandalf does actually refer to the hobbits quite a few times as like children. And, I mean, it reflects Christ's idea, in order to get to heaven, we must be like children. And I think, actually, Francis, you're coming from what Gandalf sees in the hobbits, because we see quite often in The Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, you know, he's more than what you think in regards to his position amongst the dwarfs. You know, they keep doubting him, and Gandalf says, I've chosen him for a reason. And the
yeah.
same thing when they become chosen as ring-bearers. So I think, actually, yeah, that's a huge Christian theme you've touched on there.
Mm-hmm.
And, again,
yeah,
If I could ask you quickly, I know you're going to push stuff to next week, but I saw the movie, and I was exploding here and there when they have, what's this, Gandalf's boss, what's his name again, Saruman pops in, and everybody's, So for the purists, the movie was really crazy. But when my passion came down, I started thinking about Gandalf, and what Gandalf did was somewhat out of norm. So if you read the Silmarillion, he has a lot of compassion for humans, elves, and the creatures of God, as you want. And he's drawn towards compassion and pity, as the book says. So I like how, I mean, after thinking about it, I like how Saruman and the rest and whatever don't really... They think that Gandalf is mad because he's going up after this lowly race. And I also like the portrayal of Radagast. I'm not condoning the movie at all, but I'm just saying I don't think this is what Jackson, or I think that's his name, I was thinking, but
yeah.
I'm just saying that it works somehow.
We'll discuss it more next week, but yeah, I mean, there are definitely things that work about the film, and I think that's a good point, good one that you point out there.
Well, you guys keep up the good job.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks for listening, and thanks for the call.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Yep, bye-bye.
Bye. So that pretty much takes up our time that we've allotted for discussing The Hobbit. For anyone who's just joining us, you're listening to Swords in Space Radio. We're just finishing up our discussion of The Hobbit, but in about 20 minutes from now, once we're done the show, it'll be available for download as a podcast. For about the next couple weeks or so, it'll be available still on the Restoration Radio website for download, but then it's going to be moved over to AMDG Radio, which is a new radio station that's just starting up and that's picked up the Swords in Space as one of its programs. And I'll give you a bit more details on that later. But first, as we enter into the Event Horizon segment, each episode of Swords in Space Radio, I like to end off discussing some current theme or bit of news that's recently come up in the science fiction fantasy scene. And in previous weeks, we've discussed the news of Disney buying Lucasfilm and then hiring J.J. Abrams to direct Episode 7 of Star Wars. This week, I think it's perfect to discuss Brav's Index, since we have the editor-in-chief of that website as our guest, and it's news. It's something relatively new. I'll just give you the website address. That's www.bravsindex.com. That's www.bravsindex.com, and Brav's Index is all one word. Matthew, why don't you tell us a bit about what's this all about?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for the opportunity. I am just so stoked about this site. It took me a long time to put it into gear, but, I mean, I have to give Nicholas credit here for those that have found Swords in Space Radio through his blog, Swords in Space. Nicholas was already kind of doing what I was hoping to do, and then, you know, when I met Nicholas, he had a writing club. There are other Catholic authors trying to, you know, write contemporary stuff, and I can't tell you how incredibly frustrated I am that Catholic culture is like, completely dissolved. I mean, even on the 20th century, we still had some Catholic authors going. We have nothing left, and we're kind of content, kind of, oh, you know, so-and-so wrote this piece of music so many centuries ago, or so-and-so wrote this book so many years ago. We just don't have any vibrancy left, especially in those who, you know, keep the Catholic traditions, you know, trying to keep the faith. And so when Nicholas had this writing group, it was just inspiring to meet other authors who had the kind of same vision. And then his blog, you know, he was doing contemporary stuff. And that's when I've been writing for, I think, 2 decades now. And I was like, all right, I've got to launch my site. Now, I mean, I've been sitting on this for so long, and then I launched it. So if you check out the site, it's all free. All the stories there are free. We are putting things up in print that you can buy. But if you don't want to buy them, hey, you don't have to. And it's new stuff. It's contemporary stuff. It deals with science fiction and fantasy. And I'm going to say it. It's good writing. Check it out. We got a blog on there. It's updated weekly. We've got some serials going down. You can update yourself each week on a new chapter, poetry, short stories. We've just begun, and I mean, if you've got something and you want to, I don't know, submit something or comment, please come check out the site. We'd really like you to be part of this. And yeah, it's great to kind of join Nicholas on the front here, you know, trying to push for some, you know, some cultural impetus. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, well, and I'm going to have to use Brav's Index back as my own inspiration to get back on the horse, as it were, because I haven't haven't had anything, any new fiction up on Swords in Space for a little while. So, but now that I'm healthy again and moved into my new home, I've got a few ideas bouncing around in my head, and it's just going to have to knuckle down and get to work on that.
Yeah.
Now, you said you've got a couple serials going on. Can you give
yeah.
us, in a minute or less, a little snapshot of each of the serials?
Just give them appetite. The whole idea of the serial is to have the author present the work fresh. I mean, it's been maybe sort of edited. I mean, I'm supposed to look at these things before they go online. But it gives you the opportunity to give some feedback. I mean, these are not finished scripts, so read them. If you don't like them, let us know. If there's messed up somewhere, let us know. The one by J.C. Mathis, The Sundered Sky, I think he's going for the flood, Noah's flood. He's kind of writing the world as it was, you know, a story about the flood with all these different characters. So it's kind of, it's fiction, but it's definitely revolving around that. You can check it out. I think we're up to chapter 7 on that. The themes are very obvious, I think. I mean, we might actually have to tone them down. I don't know if you think so. Let us know.
Is Sundered Sky, is it kind of a, is it like a fantasy type of feel to it? Because I admit I haven't read that one.
No, fair enough. It does have a kind of fantasy aspect insofar as it kind of gets back to the idea that words have power. So if you're able to name a thing, you can kind of control it. So if you want to call that magic, you can call it magic. And this kind of story is kind of considered magic, to know the names of things and therefore be able to manipulate them. And then they have, I think it's divided between the patriarchs and the scientists. And the scientists are the ones that can manipulate nature, but they don't know the names of things because the patriarchs are the ones that keep all the names. So scientists have to go to patriarchs to get the names of things in order to manipulate them. You have a friction kind of come up to this. You can see kind of the corruptive spiral that might result. And that's kind of the whole Noah's Ark thing coming in there, the one man who has to basically kind of save the world, but can he do it?
And when you say scientists, are we talking, what type of science, level of science, technology are we talking about? That's usually one of the things that tends to separate people's definition, whether something's fantasy or science fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
yeah,
you know, Star Wars is really fantasy, but most people consider it science fiction because it's got spaceships
It's definitely fantasy. It's like they're like alchemists. Imagine if alchemists actually had been able to do what they claimed. If they know the name for gold, they can take some material, utter the name, and it transmutes. So pure fantasy.
Okay. All right. So then I think you're going to talk about the science fiction one you got going, Revelatio.
Yeah, Revelatio. Wow, is this. I mean, this work is fantastic. It's actually 6 books. Only one of them is up. Well, being up. This is a huge project, very much in the future. What can I say? We named our site after the character Bravado. He is just a scream to read. He's this kind of, I would say he's a half-crazed super assassin. He has no loyalties. He's got no inhibitions, nothing. And then you've got this, this village, this dumpy village doctor, and they get thrown together into this world that is just being torn apart by war. The villages that the doctor comes from, the Knights Tumble, and they're going to be basically plowed under by the government. And then you've got Bravado, who absolutely hates the government. And there's not much he does like. He's quite a funny character. And he is just a one-man wrecking crew, and he goes through everything. And the reason we called it Bravado's Index is because Bravado, it reminds us of the everyman, the man that doesn't have grace but keeps trying to force, good fortune, keeps trying to force change through just pure human stubbornness and willpower. And since he has this kind of fantastic Superman-type body, I mean, the whole concept behind him is to attract readers to a comic character, basically. You know how those movies have been doing so well. But the whole point is to show that without grace, he is actually quite powerless. and that hasn't come up yet. The whole point is to attract non-Catholics to this character, and he'll eventually kind of have to, you know, kind of go into the background, and then the virtuous character come forward. So he's going to be exposed for his weaknesses. And that's something I think we have to do, because a lot of people enjoy these superhero films, but they kind of forget, you know, it's kind of, I would argue, the glorification of man. Mm-hmm. So it's quite, I mean, it's also a lot of fun writing, and I mean, there are some fantastic battles, and oh, wow, I've gotten to read, I think, up to chapter 80, and it is fantastic stuff. It's a lot of fun.
Okay, well, I definitely haven't made it that far, but I have started into that one a bit, and it's about a lot of the classic sci-fi tropes, like the rag-tag kind of, you know, motley crew of, you know, different characters that are kind of banded together, and kind of the evil empire, you know, sort of.
Yeah, it's basically a new world order, I guess you'd call it. Sure.
Yeah.
Now, if you're looking for something to read, you got nothing to read, check it out, please. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And let the author know. Let the author know.
All right, and so they can just do that under the contact tab, or do you have, contacts for the authors embedded right in the stories?
You know, no, we just have a generic contact tab at the moment. You can leave your message. I mean, right now we're pretty small. I won't lie. We get about 20 hits a day max. So we need more content, we need more people. I mean, if you're a writer, hey, we're not just looking for people to read. If you actually can write and you got some good stuff, by all means, sign up, see if you can get on the site. I mean, we're going to be trying to get good quality. We're not going to just take anything, but yeah, by all means, come on in, and you know, if you've got an author you want to correspond with, just send a message, you'll get to them.
Okay, yeah, sounds great. So again, to our listeners, that's Bravs Index, www.bravsindex.com, bravsindex.com. Check it out, and don't forget to visit this show's website, swordsandspace.com, from time to time. It's been a little quiet lately, as I mentioned, but I've got a few things in the works, and maybe time permitting, I'll if I get really back on the horse, I've had times in the past where I can really churn out a lot of work in a short period of time, I can hopefully spare something for Brav's Index, too.
Hey, we're waiting for it.
So, again, thanks to our listeners. You've been listening to Swords in Space Radio, and our topic was The Hobbit, and our guest was Matthew Zepp, and I'm very grateful to have had him with us, and he'll be back again next week when we discuss the film. And just before I close off, I mentioned that Swords in Space Radio is moving off of the Restoration Radio Network and onto AMDG Radio Network. This show will be able to be downloaded from Restoration Radio for 2 weeks, and that's going to move over to the AMDG site. You can find them at blogtalkradio.com/AMDG. That's Alpha Mike Delta Golf, if my enunciation isn't too good. They also have a Facebook page. For now, it's going to be easier to search AMDG Radio rather than me giving the 20-digit address that Facebook is giving it right now, because you need to have 30 likes before they'll give you a proper address, and AMDG is just starting up. Actually, I think Swords in Space Radio will be the first show that they have on there. I just want to thank listeners of Restoration Radio who found Swords in Space because of listening to Restoration Radio. Thank you for your support during the start of the Swords in Space show. I ask for your prayers as we move on to our new home, and not just for the radio, but for writing and for the great project that, as Matthew's discussing, the, you know, trying to get some Catholic culture, some contemporary stuff on the go, rather than, I mean, Tolkien's great, but I'd like to have other stuff to read as well. And
we have to step up. Yeah, we have to step up, take our place.
Yeah, and you know, I don't think Matthew or I pretend to be the greatest writers of all time, but hey, no one else is writing this stuff, so that
by default, we're the ones standing.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, now I know some people love it, on the internet love their conspiracy theories. I just wanted to stress that like there's no issues between me and Restoration Radio. The main reason I decided to look for another home for Swords and Space Radio is I've always intended Swords and Space, the website and the radio, as a science fiction blog and radio show that's hosted by a Catholic versus a specifically Catholic science fiction radio and fantasy radio show and blog, which may be a bit of a fine distinction, but I think there is a difference. Obviously, we're still coming from the Catholic perspective, but I want it to be a bit more of a generic show and maybe doesn't fit in perfectly with Restoration Radio as a result. So, all that said, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next week. And thanks again, Matthew. Looking forward to talking to you again in a week's time.
You too, Nicholas. Thanks for doing this, eh? We all appreciate it. Yeah.